My name is Sven Westlund, and I'm the village carpenter. About a month ago, I went on a trip to Fresno, California, to a forum called the Forum on Church and Land. It was held at the Link Care Center in Fresno. The Link Care Center is a place where they take care of tired missionaries. It looked like a little suburb in Fresno, and I really thought of it when Pastor Rico was here this weekend. He was in Papua New Guinea, and he never returned. And this center was established by a couple so that missionaries could come home and be refreshed and maybe have retraining and go back to the mission field, because they realized that there's so much that goes into the training of the missionaries, and it's lost if they don't return. So that was the setting that we were in. FOCAL is an annual event that's held over 10 years, and it started in 1985 in Northern California. It's always held someplace west of the Mississippi. And a very diverse group of people who have some interest in agriculture and church meet and are challenged by lectures, speakers, and panels on current agricultural practices and land ownership. And the purpose is to look at what is the paradigm that the agriculture is working under now, and then come up with some more desirable paradigms that will be more healthy for the people who live on the land and the creatures, and healthier for the earth itself. Every day we had a Bible study, and this year it was led by a Presbyterian professor by the name of Marvin Sheeney. He talked about life in the 8th century before our time, before current time. And he made it come alive for us, how the conditions were. And then when he presented the prophets of that time, which were Amos, Isaiah, Hosea, and Micah, they sounded like satirists from the Saturday Night Live show. It just jumped off the page at you how biting their tongue was. The room where we had the conference had a photo essay called Las Manos de la Tierra, about land and labor in the San Joaquin Valley. A lot of pictures showed the laborers arriving early in the morning in the fields, and the children playing in the irrigation ditch, and the crops being loaded on the trucks. Mostly they showed pictures of some of these very labor-intensive crops, cucumbers and berries. And it was presented by Trudy Weisemann, who also made us familiar with an old study of two similar communities in the San Joaquin Valley, Alba and Dinuba. They were similar in that they were about the same size, and they were both agricultural communities, but that's where the similarity ended. One was made up of a lot of large, or a few large landowners, and the other of a lot of individual landowners. Then the study proceeded to look into the community, or what would you call it, the lifestyle, a quality of life in those communities. And some of the things they looked at were what the schools were doing, or civic clubs. And they found that where there were few landowners, the elite were the ones who were the members of the Lions Club and the Rotary. And in the other town, it was a mixed group of people who were in these clubs. There were some other presenters that talked about the effects of the same crop in areas, which is very handy for the canneries and packing sheds, but not so good for the people who are laborers on the land. And one of the things that I picked up on was the three major areas in California where they grow oranges: Northern California, Central, and then Southern California. And Central California has the most. And the difference between the labor force used in the high months and the low months of the year for the orange crop is 12,000 people. That's quite a fluctuation. When you concentrate the crop, some of the people are laid off 24 weeks a year. Something else we were made aware of, and if you've lived in the West, you are aware of how important water is. And we heard about land water policies and how water districts are established. In California, they had two models. The older ones, where the dams and the canals were built, and the people all had a say in how it was going to be run. Irrigation districts have the right to tax, and they tax on two things: to retire the debt on the canal system and the dams, and also then on the cost of the water to pay the current expenses that they have for ditch riders and the everyday maintenance. We experienced that when we lived in Idaho. We've got two bills a year to have our water. The newer water districts in California, and they are mainly on the west and the south end of the San Joaquin Valley, the way you participate in them is by the value of your land. So it's not one man, one vote. It's how much value is your land. And so the large landowners, they have the say on what goes on. And they may not even live in the community. And that has begun to show up in some way, pretty undesirable ways, because the big cities, and mainly Southern California with Los Angeles and Orange County, they need water bad. So they buy water. So then they can take water from one place and transfer it to some other place, which either leaves a big area dry, or the people who sell it, they start to pump and take it out of the ground. And it has a large effect on community life. Something else that happens is that the bank may tell a farmer, well, you could sell your water rights, and then you wouldn't be in debt so bad. So they hold that over the farmer's head. It's detrimental to the community, and the community hasn't got say in it, because many of the people don't own any land. We also spent a day on a field trip to view the area, and what we looked at was a farm. And this particular farmer, he grew peaches and grapes, and he gave us a lesson in how to buy peaches. You have to know your variety. If you buy by the color, you go wrong. The yellow peach may be more delicious than the one that's red. But peaches ripen from May to October. Every week a new variety comes on. And if you want good peaches, you have to know which varieties are good, and you have to insist that your grocer tell you what varieties he's selling. We also looked at the farm chemical dealer, and they are not only governed by federal EPA, there's also a California EPA. And I remember the 5 years we lived in California, I often came to the farm chemical dealers, and things have changed a lot. There isn't a drop of water that falls on that place that's not gathered up someplace. From all the payment and where it runs off the roof, it's gathered together. So there won't be any runoff of any chemicals that may have been spilled. The chemicals that could give off dangerous fumes in case of a fire, They're all located in one area, and the fire department know exactly what's in there, so that their people would not be in danger when they come to fight fires. We visited a packing house, and they were busy with oranges, and it's amazing the abuse an orange can take. They wash them, wax them, and sort them, and the sorting is all with machinery. What
Why
we learned,
do they wax them?
What's that?
Why do they wax them, did they say?
It's probably for appearance, and I'll tell you something else about appearance, and we learned that at the farm chemical dealer and at the packing house is that 80% of the chemicals that are used on oranges are used to give them a better appearance. And I didn't really like to hear that. But a green orange can really be delicious, but we don't believe so. So they do all they can to make the oranges orange. Another place we visited was a relief center. It was set up after the Great Freeze. And the Great Freeze was something we in Idaho experienced, and you did in Washington too, if you lived here, just before Christmas in 90. There was a week of severe frost. And they only had 20% of the orange crop picked. So all that was left for the workers to do was to go out and strip the rotten fruit off the trees. So there were many, many people that needed immediate relief. And the federal government didn't pick up on this for 4 months. They were busy with the war. So most of the help was given by churches. And since it was the orange crop that was damaged and not the others that were dormant, it could concentrate on just these areas where they had the oranges. And so it wasn't just a burden on the churches right in that town or those little towns. The denominations helped them, and I have the statistics on how many people they helped, and they are still helping. The only requirement was that you must have lived there when the freeze hit. So people who just happened to move in and be there later, they couldn't get any relief. The field trip took us to a little place called Early Mart, a small community right on Highway 99. The reason we went there was that it was a cancer cluster town, and they have three of them in the valley. Early on in another town, I believe it's called McFarland, it had been discovered that the children had cancer, more children than would usually be found in a community. And the public, of course, right away rang an alarm and went in and spent money they didn't even have to examine all the children. And I believe that particular place had 13 children that had cancer. What they did find that so over 70% of the children had never been to the dentist, and more than 25% were anemic. Health conditions were generally pretty bad. Now, this town, Early Mart, was discovered later when it was not sensational news anymore, and the people in this town said the reason that nobody had ever paid attention to the fact that they were a cancer cluster town was that it was the farm workers union that had discovered it. And they felt that just the fact that it was the union that had done it, that the press didn't want to cover it. It was sort of a depressing trip to go out. There, it was very evident that it was large landholders, because there weren't any mailboxes around the road when we drove there. And the big tour bus that we drove up in looked very much out of place when it parked out in front of the little church where we met the people. And we met some of the people whose children had been affected with the cancer. They had formed a group, and the town barber was the head of it, and they did take donations, and they helped each other the best they could. One of the stories we got there was about a little girl who was present. She'd had cancer in the kidney, and her parents were given the choice between donating a kidney to her or have her receive radiology treatments, and they chose the latter. And they lived an hour and a half drive from Fresno, and that's where they had to take their daughter. But sometimes they had to have donations for the gasoline to get there, and they had never been able to stay at the McDonald House while the child had treatment, because it cost $6 for him to stay there, so they had to stay in the car. The hardest for the thing for the family was the fact that one of the older siblings had to be a translator for the doctor, between the doctor and the patient. And the girl finally couldn't take it anymore with seeing all the suffering that her little sister had. And I don't know how they sorted after that, but it had been very traumatic for the older child. Some of the other things that we were made aware of that the local people felt were setbacks for them and for agriculture in general was that the 160 acre limitation on receiving federally funded reclamation water was changed to 960 acres. It was a law that was never enforced. When the federal government got into the dam building after the turn of the century, the intent was that the water should be used for family farms. And it was decided that 160 acres per person would be an adequate amount. But since it was never enforced, farms grew big. And the farmers then got that taxpayer-supported water for their farms. And when there was a movement to change it, or to make the law enforced, not to change it, just to have the Bureau of Reclamation enforce the law, there was a lot of lobbying to not do it. And I remember working for a farmer at that time in California who deeded his land out to his five children and wife so that he would still be able to receive water. They changed it to 960 acres, and in reality it means that there is no limit. There are huge farms and people who have title to 960 acres and never see the land. And they make it work, and they get the subsidized water. Another setback that was shared with us was that there have been laws governing foreign trade, but they've been replaced by trade agreements. And trade agreements are not subject to the democratic process. We elect the people who make the laws, but we do not elect the people who are appointed to enforce the law and the trade agreements. In California itself, we were told that 10 years ago, the hourly rate for a farm worker was above 5.25. Now it's 4.25. And that has gone hand in hand with the fact that 10 years ago there were more than 100,000 people that belonged to the UFW, and now there are only 10,000. But everybody agreed that they're not ready for another grape boycott, because a grape boycott really hurt a lot of the farmers that complied. But you couldn't see in the grocery store where the grapes came from, and so you boycotted the people who tried to comply, or the people who had signed up with the union. It was a hard thing, and they felt that was a setback. I have attended one previous focal conference in Caldwell, Idaho. And I always wanted to attend again, but you know how it is when you have a job, it's hard to find time and hard to find money. And I was really glad I could go this year, and I'm really thankful that Holden Village registered me. And Eastern Washington, Idaho Synod, they assisted me with some funds for some of my other expenses. And I have come back feeling more strongly than ever that the church has a duty to speak up prophetically against big agribusiness. There aren't any laws broken, but we can't say that we have justice. We have plenty of laws, but justice doesn't really prevail. When we were there, I heard somebody prophetically say that someday land ownership would be looked at as just as immoral as owning people once was. We may not see that, but as the earth gets more crowded, that may be the case. And when Isaiah speaks again, adding field to field and house to house, the message still applies today. They did it in his day. They encouraged larger farms. They encouraged growing of wheat for exports on certain soils and growing grapes and olive oil for wine and for oil, all for export. And you probably remember in Isaiah the story about the man who plants a vineyard and he gathers up the rock and builds fences around it in a watchtower. Our study leader, he asked us, why do you think they built a watchtower there? It was because of the people whose land had been appropriated to do this kind of work. They were the ones that had to be kept out. It wasn't any other reason. So what I think we should consider is that since we are only on earth such a short time, maybe we shouldn't build a castle for ourselves. If it would be better to cooperate with our Maker. And I'll quote to you again, many of you heard me say it before, that we are only temporarily not dirt. And let's use this short time when we're not dirt to a good purpose. Have you got any questions? Any of the stuff I talked about, did you feel I didn't say enough about? Right?
Did they talk about pesticide use and I don't know, the great the farm workers? I never really understood the controversy there. Maybe you understand it better.
One of the farm workers in early March said, "Don't buy grapes." The people there felt that it was the use of chemicals in the vineyards around their homes that caused the children's cancer. They had a very simplified view of things. The wife said, "Well, if we'd just known, we could have put a filter on our water." But I didn't share her optimism. I don't think it's that simple. There was a reporter who came out there. I don't think he was in a bus, but somehow he showed up when we were there, who had been very interested in this. And he felt that more likely the adults have been affected and there's some DNA damage. And then it can be intensified in the children, and then they're really born being susceptible to getting a cancer. But of course he couldn't prove his case either, and if you don't go in and make big studies, which nobody wants to spend money on, you don't know for sure.
Could these children all have the same kind of cancer?
No, they don't. One was talking about his 60-year-old boy who had leukemia, so it was not the same kind of cancer.
This is an interdenominational.
The gathering? Yes. The It's mostly United Methodists that have got this started, but United Church of Christ and ELCL Lutherans were there too. Mm-hmm. The pastor who translated for us when we were at Early Mart, because these people didn't speak English, mm-hmm. was a Lutheran pastor from Livingston. And he was just exhausted with all the story he had to tell and all the questions we had. He also had led our worship. We didn't call it Vespers like we do here. We had worship every night. And all of us had been asked to bring something sacred from where we came. But since the letter that told me to do that got off the boat when I got off the boat, when I got on, I hadn't brought anything sacred, but when I heard about it, I had something anyway, because our boy had given me a little phone directory, a little computer. You could punch in the name and the phone number, and before I left, I had dutifully punched in every phone number I thought I would need when I got outside, where I could use a phone. And then when I wanted to use it, it didn't work. So I had garbage with me, and the evening we were asked to present our sacred object, I put my garbage out on the floor, and I told them that here at Holden Village, we sort everything by hand. The director sorts by hand, and everybody else too, because it's an important thing for us that we recycle as much as we can, and that we cannot bury anything. Everything is sent back out. So I sound a little bit like Mark Douglas.
Sven, you talked about the water rights and for those landowners that had like 900 acres or something. Mm-hmm. Was that a local law or was that a federal?
No, that's a federal law that has been changed to allow it to be 960 acres.
So it seems like that really encourages or promotes the large landowner philosophy. And
yeah.
Seems like if things are going to be reversed, that we have to convince our federal government of that as well.
Well, that's what part of the work needs to be done. And I said that it was the water was intended to family farms when it was first, when the water projects first started. It was also intended for estuaries. So, and I've seen that several places. And it seems to be the lowlands where drainage is kind of poor, that's where we have the wildlife refuge. But they're wonderful. Close to where we lived, there was a lake that was part of the irrigation system and wildlife refuge around it. It was not a federal project, but it creates a whole new life in the desert, and bald eagles and geese most of the year, and ducks. That was one of the intents of the law, and I think that will still be there.
How many more of those meetings will there be?
There should be three more meetings. And it was intended that the first 3 years, the first three meetings would be set up to look at the present situations, and the last seven then would try to work towards solutions. And that was my one disappointment with this, that I didn't catch the continuity. And you couldn't tell that we were working to solutions. It seemed like we were still looking at problems. And it may be the case that they just want to highlight the problems, and each of us try to be active in solution making. But it was not pronounced, and part of my evaluation was that I missed that. Because I thought it was, I was very caught up with the vision of Focal when I first heard about it and went there the second year. because I thought that was very, very ambitious to think that we could point the way to a solution. It would really be wonderful. The place that I first heard the fact that God was given credit for the good was out there at Early Mart. The people out there who couldn't speak English, they could tell us anyway through the interpreter that it was God. Conference hadn't also mentioned that it is God who grants the change. I would have missed that part of it altogether. He was a Jesuit who had worked quite a bit in Central America. So that there really was a variety of people there. There were also one of the presenters was a Quaker. And they said a lot. And if I'm not saying a lot, I guess it's because it's just sticking, but it's not escaping. That's why I was hoping you would ask me a few more questions. Stir it up a little.
Well, actually, I think you did a really nice job of encapsulating what you learned. It seems like you didn't miss a meeting to go golfing.
No, I didn't. Well, I thank you for coming here and listening.
Is the ELCA asking you also to do a bit of a report for them, or?
They haven't, but I've mailed them the same that I used here to prepare to speak to you, because they did help me with $100.
Mm-hmm. Is that from the region?
The region, together with the Synod, found the money, I was told, and I don't know for sure if it came, whose budget it came from.
Because I know that they're very interested in farm ministry and mm-hmm. problems of farmers, and the smaller farmers, yeah. So yes, I'm glad. Thank you so much, this was great.
The song that we had at Vespers last Wednesday night was a song that I learned at the Fogel Conference. Mm-hmm. I'm glad you would stay here and listen to me. Before I left, Scott told me twice that I would have to give a report. And when he came back from the 2 week out he had, it wasn't 30 seconds we've been together, he asked me about a report. And now I hope he will listen to the tape.